call the Commerce Committee to order. I'm aware of two or three of our members have bills up as we speak, and they will be coming in a little bit, but I think we might have a lengthy discussion here. It might take a little while, so I think we've got to get started. Of course, we're talking about the auditor's report on Minshew. We give you guys a lot of credit. You've been in a sprint here, long meetings in the last couple of days, so we appreciate you coming again today. So with that, I think we'll turn it. I'm sure I'm somewhat disappointed we don't have the major, what I call a major players from Minshew here this afternoon. This is an extremely important part of the bill of the Commerce Committee, that is. And I guess they have a board meeting, but I don't know how many are on the board, like seven, and I thought that our committee's, you know, integral part of this whole thing. But that's the way it is, so I just wanted to get that out that I... And we have Mr. Johnson here, which is fine. We appreciate you coming, but I'll repeat that I think that the others should be here on this important committee meeting. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the absence of the other folks, I would request that we have the other folks from the Minshew committee another day. I think that after you hear this report.
Absolutely, and I fail to mention that that's going to happen. That's going to happen.
You.
And this isn't on a fast track, this bill at all. This, you know, we kind of had some good ideas last year or the year before, and quite frankly, some weren't adopted. But we're going to go a little slower here in this committee because this is commerce and this is insurance, and we're going to try to do, if possible, to do this thing right. Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, and I just want to reiterate or make the committee aware, just take you back to when we talked about this, when we first enacted it. There were several issues that this committee in particular had issues with, and several of them I think we'll talk about during the report. But it is very important, I think, that the Commerce Committee talk about insurance agents, the autonomy of Minshew. Those were things that we talked about before in this committee. We had concerns about the funding and sustainability, you know, the makeup of the board, whether or not that was the way that we thought would be helpful. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you're having this particular one, but I agree that we need to have additional input from
Senator. A lot of the things you mentioned, you're absolutely correct. We talked about that in this committee, and they weren't incorporated. And I think you'll find some of those same remarks in the report. But with that, Mr. Nobles, you are to begin, and thank you again for your work in this area.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jim Nobles, legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Joel Alter, who is the manager of our evaluation. Mr. Chairman and members, we really want to thank you. Yes, we had a full day yesterday of hearings in the House and Senate, but we also really appreciate this committee inviting us because we, I think, do have some important findings and recommendations for you to consider as well. Mr. Chairman and members, judgments about Minshew and the Affordable Care Act often reflect a person's philosophical position and political affiliation, and we understand that. But as a nonpartisan audit and evaluation office, the Office of the Legislative Auditor does not have a position on whether the ACA is good or bad, nor do we have a position on whether the state of Minnesota should have created its own health insurance exchange. That was really a choice for the elected officials of this state. Our task was to evaluate how well Minshew performed in its first year, and we do have a position on that. We think Minshew performed poorly. That is actually a hard statement for me to make because we've interacted with the people at Minshew for quite a long time now, and we know that they worked very hard. Some of those state employees worked long hours for many, many months trying to make Minshew a success. But despite their hard work, And despite the fact that we spent tens of millions of dollars, Minsure did not deliver what was promised. Minsure said that on October 1, 2013, it would open for business and provide people in the state of Minnesota with an easy, seamless way to shop, compare, and purchase a private health insurance plan or to become eligible for a public health program. Minsure fell far short of that promise. Minsure did not provide a good shopping experience for many people who needed insurance and who tried to obtain it through Minsure. Far too many people struggled in frustration for hours trying to navigate Minsure's website and then waited some additional time to get help from the Minsure call center. In addition, and this is an important point, Minsure did not provide the state of Minnesota, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, with a reliable mechanism for determining whether people are eligible for the state's public health programs. And having a modernized, fully integrated electronic eligibility determination system was a key reason why the state decided to create Minsure. Yes, to offer commercial insurance in the private market, but also to modernize the state's ability to determine whether or not people are eligible for the public programs. We did an audit of whether or not Minsure is doing that well and issued that report in November, and we found serious problems in the ability of Minsure to offer clear, accurate, reliable eligibility determinations. Minsure did get us closer than we got with Health Match. Health Match, some years ago, was trying to achieve the same thing, and it completely failed. So Minsure got us somewhat closer, but it still does not provide DHS and the state with what is needed. And that is a fully functioning, fully reliable eligibility determination system. And they are still, to this day, working on that. As a result of that inability of Minsure to provide that, many eligibility determinations for public programs had to be made and continue to have to be made by county workers, sometimes working with paper applications. So again, on the question of Minsure's performance in its first year of operations, we concluded Minsure did not deliver what was promised, what was expected, or what was needed. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask Mr. Alter to make a presentation to you of our report.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alter. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you again, and thanks for working overtime, you two, especially you two. So, Mr. Alter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Joel Alter with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I also want to acknowledge behind me Ryan Moltz and Laura Schwartz, who worked on this evaluation. We were asked by the Legislative Audit Commission back last spring to take a look at Minsure, and I think everyone knew it had been a rough first year. A lot of negative publicity. As we went about our work, we tried to presume nothing. We tried to, where possible, go to people who had firsthand understanding of what happened. We tried to look at original documents. We looked at an enormous amount of data. And we initiated a number of surveys of consumers and people who helped consumers so that we could better understand exactly what happened. Mostly, as Jim said, we focused on the first year of Minsure's enrollment. As you know, the second enrollment period started in mid-November of 2014 and just wrapped up last weekend. In terms of the overall conclusions of the report, as Mr. Noble said, we concluded that Minsure's failures in the first year of enrollment outweighed its achievements. Yes, there were many people who did enroll through Minsure, and many people were pleased with the products that they found online through Minsure. But the problems people experienced, whether they got stuck in the system or were on hold for hours or had other issues, those problems were unacceptable. And as we discussed, we think that the legislature should find ways to establish clearer lines of accountability for both Minsure, the agency, as well as the enrollment system it has created. I want to say a few words about health insurance exchanges as background. Exchanges, or marketplaces as they're often called, were established and authorized by the Affordable Care Act, and exchanges intended to simplify the process of buying insurance, helping consumers to make comparisons of insurance products so that you can look at what's covered by this product, what would my premiums be, what might my other out-of-pocket costs be, can I get the doctor that I want? States had some options. They could either develop their own health insurance exchange, they could develop one working in partnership with the federal government, or they could rely entirely on the federal government's exchange. And this year, Minnesota is one of 13 states, plus the District of Columbia, that are running state-based exchanges. Most states are using the federal exchange. There are also, as I'm sure many of you are aware, there are private health insurance exchanges out there and have been for many years. And some might say, well, why do we need to have a state-run exchange? The Affordable Care Act authorized tax credits and other subsidies, and those are only available to people who purchase through a federally authorized exchange. A few things about MNsure, the agency. As the chairman mentioned, this agency really is defined in law as a board, a seven-member governing board. The lead staff person is appointed by the board, and that would be the CEO of MNsure. MNsure has a substantial budget, about $119 million in fiscal year 2015, and that budget is expected to decline in coming years as federal funds gradually go away. In addition, MNsure receives a portion of its operating money from the Department of Human Services, and MNsure collects a portion of the premium payments that are paid for products that are purchased through MNsure. MNsure follows some of the same laws that other state agencies follow, but it was also given some important exemptions. For example, when MNsure does rulemaking, it can follow an expedited process. It's exempt from many of the state's procurement laws, and MNsure's IT projects are not required by law to have the same level of oversight by the Office of Minute Services that other agencies experience. Separate from MNsure, the agency, is this enrollment system that MNsure has built, and Minnesota has received about $189 million to build that system. Not all of it has been spent yet. The Department of Human Services has also received some additional money, both federal and state, to help modernize its public program eligibility systems. The MNsure enrollment system can enroll people in either commercial or insurance or public programs like medical assistance. And that's different from what you'll find in many states. In this state, it's kind of a one-stop shop, whether you're going for a public program or commercial insurance. And we do have many families in the state that are what are sometimes referred to as blended families, where they have some members who are on a public program, other members who want to get commercial insurance. MNsure does provide a place where you can look for both options. The federal and state governments have not delegated responsibility for public program eligibility decisions to MNsure. That remains with the Department of Human Services. But DHS's intent has been to rely a lot on the MNsure enrollment system for that purpose. I think to no one's surprise, this report confirms that there were, in fact, numerous user problems with MNsure, that they were widespread and they were serious. And I think one of the issues was the time in which this complex system was developed. Time was always in short supply. MNsure got off to a late start out of the gate, getting a federal grant, and it took 3 years to authorize the statutory language. And let me just show that graphically here with this timeline, showing, first of all, that the Affordable Care Act passed in March of 2010, and then MNsure enrollment started in October of 2013. Next, I put up on the slide here, 48 states got their first federal grant to explore whether they would develop an exchange. 48 states got their first grant in September of 2010. Minnesota was not one of those states. At that time, the governor had issued an executive order prohibiting state agencies from applying for any planning grants. So it was not until after there had been an election and a new governor That Minnesota, that executive order was repealed, and Minnesota applied for and ultimately received in February 2011 a planning grant. So there was a five-month lag between when most states got their initial grants and when Minnesota got its. On this next slide, look at when state legislation passed. March 2013, which is about 3 years to the date after the ACA passed, but that was only, you know, about 6 months before the MNsure enrollment system went live. Also, by statute, the MNsure board did not assume its full responsibilities until it had adopted bylaws and policies, and that didn't occur until late August of 2013, literally about 5 weeks before the enrollment system went live. Some other time issues. It took exchange officials longer than they expected to select vendors who would build the new IT system. And then once the vendors were picked, MNsure had second thoughts about the work of those vendors. Only about 6 months into that contract, MNsure initiated changes in the roles that would be played by the vendors. For many aspects of the exchange, there were federal rules that were issued, and many of those rules were very late in coming out, well into 2013 in some cases. And so in cases where those rules were essential for building the software, obviously this made a tight timeline even more difficult. Some people have said, well, MNsure really had no choice but to go live on October 1st, 2013. And we had a discussion with federal officials about that very point. And based on the discussion we had, I guess our conclusion was that there was a little bit, but not a lot of give in that timeline that we were working under. If a state really believed that its technology was not going to be functional on October 1st, 2013, it could have gone to the feds and said, we're not going to make it. And if they had given the feds several months of heads up, it would have been possible for the state to go with the federal exchange because that time was needed to ensure that all the right connections were made. We never requested a postponement in that date, and it didn't happen. Aside from the issues of time that I've talked about so far, I think there were issues of agency execution. Exchange officials were reluctant initially to involve the Office of Minute Services, and they are our state's IT experts. They were reluctant to involve them in a meaningful way in what was a very complicated IT project. Minute did ultimately kind of work its way into the process and did play a meaningful role, but not a role to the extent that it would normally play in almost any other agency's IT project. A new IT system requires a lot of testing, and that's certainly true for our public programs, which have extremely complicated eligibility rules. In the end, there was really very little testing done of the MNsure system, involving way too few scenarios. The tests that were done didn't go well, and when there were problems identified, there often wasn't enough time to make a change before October 1st, 2013. We had multiple vendors on this project, and so it was always going to be a challenge to integrate the work of those various vendors. Well before the testing was done, there were already red flags that this was going to be a risky project and that there were going to be real challenges in going live effectively on October 1st. Challenges to the project's scope and schedule and quality control. MNsure officials tended to put a good face on things. There were problems with functionality that were not adequately communicated to the board members of MNsure or to top executive branch officials. When MNsure did go live, I think the hope among staff was, well, we're going to try to fix these on the fly. They knew that there were unresolved issues, but they had good hopes that those could still be fixed. Their efforts to fix those problems ultimately led to new ones, and it was not as easy as they had hoped. What was the impact of the technical problems? I'll talk more in a moment about the consumer problems and the frustration, but the number of people who were adversely affected by those problems was large. The Department of Human Services, another impact, the Department of Human Services had hoped to migrate everybody who was already, prior to MNsure, in the medical assistance program and in Minnesota Care to move them over to the MNsure enrollment system. There were literally hundreds of thousands of those cases, and the idea was to move everybody there in 2014. But DHS and the counties didn't have the confidence in the MNsure system to make that move, and so those cases remained in DHS's old, what are called legacy systems. And a key impact is that in addition to remaining there, there were no redeterminations done in those cases, eligibility redeterminations to see if those individuals still qualified for the program. Does the fact that those redeterminations were not done, did that have a cost impact to the state? Undoubtedly it did, although it would be very hard to quantify exactly what it was. Meanwhile, counties and insurers struggled because of the limited functionality of the system. For example, on the county side, counties can't even today determine how many cases they have on their own MA case rolls. If they have a person on the MA caseload, let's say, who has a birth, and so somebody new needs to be added to that case, it now takes about 60 to 90 minutes for a county to do that. Using the old, outdated systems, it took about 5 minutes. And another example on the insurer side, I think insurers expected an efficient process so that when someone had enrolled through MNsure, that information would get transmitted to the insurer in an efficient way. But instead, it has been a very manual, multi-file kind of process that has just not worked well. Turning to a discussion of enrollments through MNsure during the first open enrollment period, in October 2013, MNsure set a target of enrolling 135,000 people by the end of open enrollment at the end of March 2013. And as we see here, that number did climb over open enrollment, and ultimately, by the end of open enrollment, 186,000 people had enrolled. So it seemed like a good news story. MNsure had surpassed its goal. What we found, though, was that the 135,000 target that had been set by MNsure was a flawed one. It contained a serious error, one made by the Department of Human Services. DHS mistakenly estimated that over the course of a six-month period, the open enrollment period, only 12,000 people would enroll in the medical assistance program. And that was an unrealistically low estimate that ultimately got incorporated into the MNsure target. And so if we were to look at a more reasonable target, that would have been well above where the actual number of enrollments that MNsure achieved during the open enrollment period. I want to mention a few things about the commercial enrollments that occurred through MNsure during the first year. I think we were able to look at a lot of data, and it's an interesting profile. One thing we found is that, excuse me, the age group with the largest number of enrollees was, in fact, a somewhat older group, the 55 to 64 age group. As you know, the products that were sold through MNsure were all rated by actuaries. They were given what were called meta levels. For example, a platinum product was one where the coverage of the what were called essential health benefits was 90% of the value of those benefits, whereas other products offered lower coverage amounts. The most common plan sold through MNsure was a silver level plan, one which covered 70% of the essential health benefits. The most common insurer during the first year was Preferred One. And as you know, Preferred One chose not to participate in the second year, but they sold about 60% of the plans, the commercial plans that were sold to MNsure. We don't have much to tell you, unfortunately, about the racial and ethnic composition of who enrolled in MNsure. The questions about that on the application were voluntary, and there were other problems with the data that were reported that unfortunately, we just can't tell you much, even though MNsure set targets, goals for racial and ethnic enrollment, but there's not much that we can tell you that's meaningful. Of the people who enrolled in commercial insurance, we found that at least 41% received the advanced premium tax credit, and that's what's used to reduce the cost of individuals' premiums. For those people that did receive this tax credit, the average monthly amount of that tax credit was $154 per month. In addition, there were some people, about 13% of the commercial enrollees, who received what's called a cost-sharing reduction, which is a way that you can reduce your out-of-pocket cost on an ongoing basis through MNsure. So we've got about a little over 40% who got the tax credit, 13% who got the cost-sharing reduction. There were some people who got both, but I guess think of it as perhaps about 50% of the people got some type of tax credit or other subsidy.
How come, excuse me, and if members have questions as we go along, because sometimes that's when you think of them, but is that pretty typical that just 40% got tax credits? Is that like the national? Why isn't that higher, I guess?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a good question, and I'm not sure I have a good answer or a good comparison with other states, but given that, you know, the real attraction of coming to MNsure as opposed to going to
tax credits.
Right, tax credits or a cost subsidy, you know, that's why you would do it. But people could go to MNsure and perhaps find products. I mean, let's say that you had somebody who had employer-sponsored insurance, and they thought, well, maybe I can get a better deal through MNsure. They could do that. They could go to MNsure and buy insurance through MNsure. They would not be eligible for the tax credits, but they could still, if they found that there was a better product out there, they could buy it there.
So, Jetson on this.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I thought if you had qualified health through your employer, you were not allowed to purchase private insurance on the exchange.
Mr. Alter. Mr. Chairman, Senator Jensen, I believe that you still could under the circumstances that I just mentioned. And in addition, if in fact your employer-sponsored coverage was deemed not affordable,
yeah,
I think even then you would qualify for the tax credit. But I think even if you, as my understanding is that you could buy insurance, you're shaking your head. But
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I would have to. That's what I went through the training, the certified. To be a certified broker to do this.
We'll follow
I need some clarification, please, because my understanding was if your employer was offering you an adequately, I mean, it had to be, if it wasn't considered affordable, I mean, we have to do that calculation right up front before we can even, if it's considered affordable,
right.
You have to take that and you really are not qualified. You cannot purchase a tax plan, qualified health plan on the exchange.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, we'll get back to you on that.
Again,
our understanding was you could purchase but just not be eligible for the tax credit.
Okay.
But
maybe that is true.
It's an important point and worth clarifying.
It's a very important point, I believe, and others do it. Senator Kosoka, on this issue?
Yeah, I was just going to make a comment about, you know, the tax credits was part of it. But I think more importantly is we said it's mandated. You know, you don't have a choice. You've got to get coverage, and so they're going to try to find an avenue to do that. And I, you know, as we talk about the success, I would say had we simply mandated it and not done a $180 million project, that we would have the same results, similar to when we required seatbelts for people. When we mandated it, people do it.
Okay. You may.
Mr. Chair, the last point I wanted to make here is from our analysis, one of the things we did is we compared the number of people who enrolled through MNsure in different parts of the state with the number of uninsured people in those parts of the state, just as a way of getting a sense of the relative success that MNsure may have had in those parts of the state. It appeared from our analysis that enrollment was weaker in the northwest and the southwest parts of the state than in other parts. Many people have asked what's been the impact of MNsure on the number of uninsured in Minnesota. There's a lot that we don't know at this point. We do know from a study at the University of Minnesota last year that the number of uninsured people dropped by about 180,000, roughly from the fall of 2013 to the spring of 2014. Most of that drop was people who went on to the medical assistance roles in the state. There may have been a variety of factors that contributed to that. This was a period when the medical assistance program expanded in Minnesota. It was a period when the federal mandate to have insurance kicked in, and it was a period when MNsure was out trying to recruit people to enroll. It's just hard to know exactly what contributed how much to that reduction in the uninsured. In the survey that we conducted of consumers who enrolled through MNsure, we found that 28% were not insured immediately prior to their MNsure enrollment. I think that's been one of the questions. How many people were uninsured before they went through MNsure? At least of the commercial enrollees, 28% from our survey were not insured immediately prior. Earlier I mentioned the consumer problems that many people faced. We do think that there were things that were good about the consumer experience. I'm going to show a little bit of both here, and I'll start with the negative side. The enrollment process was long, and it was complex for many people. In our survey of people who successfully enrolled, they said that the time it took them to complete the whole enrollment process, both online or on the phone or meeting with an in-person assister, was about 4 hours on average. 75% of the users we surveyed reported having significant technical problems with the website. Navigators and brokers also reported large numbers of technical problems. We discuss in the report that some of the application questions on the application form online were quite difficult to understand. There are some examples in the report on page 85 if you want to look at any of those. I'm not going to discuss any of them in detail right now. There were also serious problems with notification of consumers about their applications. For 6 months in 2014, applicants did not receive notification of their eligibility for tax credits. And for 6 months, people with pending applications for public programs, these were applications that were not yet complete, were not informed that those applications were still pending or what they needed to do to fix them. On the positive side, there was more satisfaction than dissatisfaction with the products that people actually purchased. Two-thirds of people said that they would purchase the same product again if given the chance through MNsure. Keep in mind that many people purchased a preferred one product the first year, so they couldn't purchase the exact same thing through MNsure the second year in that case. I should mention, too, that 43% of people said that their MNsure product lowered their overall health costs. 26% said it increased. I think the other positive to report is that the MNsure site did provide an opportunity for people to not only to shop and make comparisons, but also, again, look at either public program or commercial options and to find out what the impact of the tax credits would be, all of that in one place, which is something that hadn't existed previously. We looked in depth at the experience of users with the MNsure call center, and our conclusion was that customer service was inadequate. Many people had to wait for very long times when they called MNsure's helplines. Over the course of an entire year, about a third of the calls to that call center were abandoned. MNsure's goal had been to have that rate be no more than 5%. And as you can see in the chart, there were very high abandonment rates during open enrollment and then again during the summer of 2014. A lot of that had to do with staffing. MNsure didn't have enough of its own staff at the call center. It took them several months to get a backup call center in place. It was that was not in place until there were less than 2 months left in open enrollment in 2014. MNsure has, for the most recent open enrollment period, added both a lot of staff and a backup call center. So things, we assume, have been more smooth.
Senator Reinhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question. Mr. Alter, as you may imagine, we've been tracking this for a little bit now, and I heard that figure in one of the previous presentations. Can you give me a description for abandonment? Is that someone called and was left on hold? The phone didn't get answered? I mean, what it, I know what I feel like when I'm abandoned. I don't know what it feels like when someone's trying to get through to MNsure.
Mr. Chair and Senator Reinhart, and I'll be corrected if I'm wrong here, but a call that's abandoned is one that actually gets through. I mean, there has been some connection with the call center. Presumably, it would be they would be on hold and they would hang up before they successfully reach.
Thank you.
A person.
Okay. Thank you. Continue.
The other thing to say about customer service is, and we heard this from consumers, brokers, navigators, navigators, and others. But the quality of information at the call center was not what it should have been that first year either. The hiring, the training that occurred was rushed. And so people would call and they would sometimes get conflicting answers when they talked to different people. A lot of people had technical problems. The call center was not able to answer many of those questions. And there was little coordination with the other call centers outside of Minshew that they often referred people to. To help people who were encountering problems, Minshew did have a network of what are called assisters. They were certified by Minshew to help people enroll. They'd received some training for this purpose. This included people like, you've heard the term navigators. Typically, these people work for community organizations. You had brokers who worked for insurance companies. You had another group called certified application counselors who typically work for hospitals and clinics. Minshew provided about $5 million in grants to organizations that employed navigators. We found that there was very limited oversight of grantee activities, and the grantees were not held accountable during the first year for meeting the enrollment goals that were set in their contracts with Minshew. The roles of the assisters were not as clear and distinct as they should have been. Some people would go to a navigator hoping that person would be able to help them through the whole process. They might get to a certain point and the navigator would say, well, I can't advise you on this. Now you're going to have to go see a broker. And it happened the other way as well. Somebody would go see a broker. Maybe somewhere in the process, let's say it became clear that this person was perhaps going to be a public program enrollee, and that person might get referred back to a navigator. It happened both ways, but not ideal customer service. Brokers helped a lot of people during the process for whom they received no compensation. Brokers could be compensated for commercial clients only if they were appointed by the insurer for that product, and that was not as well understood as it should have been during the process. So some people may have helped someone who enrolled in a commercial product. It was one that the broker was not appointed to serve, and then they were not compensated.
I think it was this committee that put in brokers and agents to get paid for their services, and that's what we wanted to do, and that's what this committee added in the budget or the bill. But
we did.
It's not happening. I guess, Senator. Are you getting paid? I don't know. Senator Jensen.
So, Senator Jensen. Mr. Chair, we had a hearing just recently, and they were talking about the field that the agents and brokers were to use to identify their work on that. Did you do any research or auditing on, because the way we understand it now, or I understand it, is that that's a dead field or one that's not actually getting carried on to the insurance companies. So I'm wondering if you did any work on that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, let me make sure I understand. Is this where they're indicating whether they provided service to an individual on the application form? Is that?
That's correct.
She wants to get room at the desk.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, we heard complaints from brokers that they weren't getting credit for some of those cases where they helped people and had marked the field. We didn't do any testing of that field to determine that.
There was a clear mandate, I believe we can call it a mandate, that came out of this committee that people get paid. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not happening. Senator Dames, did you? Or Senator Reinhart?
And I think, Mr. Chair, you kind of want to get through this, and then we'll have a bigger discussion. But, you know, just to your point, there was a clear mandate from this committee as well that insurance and brokers, if they're going to be doing this work, have some stake in this. And I think when we get to the governance structure issue, some of that will come out. And I know that's a topic I'd like to return to during
the
conversation.
That's a good point. Good point. Okay, continue on, sir.
Because of the frustration that brokers had, many of them didn't return for the second year to seek certification through Minshew. So we've got a lot fewer brokers in the system helping people right now. And I think If there's a feeling that there are too few brokers to make this work, we put forth a couple of options that could at least be considered. One is something that some other states have done, which is called universal appointment, so that if you get certified through MNsure, then you would be guaranteed that if you enroll somebody in a commercial plan, that you're going to get compensation from an insurer. That's not a guarantee right now. Another option would be if a broker does help somebody go through the process and that person enrolls in a public program, there actually is a provision that exists in state law that allows brokers to receive compensation from the Department of Human Services for those cases. It's not widely understood. Our understanding is it's rarely used, but that would be another option, would be to have compensation of brokers for public enrollments and consider ways to make that better known and used more often. Turning to governance, I want to spend a little bit of time on this. We mentioned that MNsure has a 7-member board. It's an unusual structure. Most of our major state agencies have a commissioner, but they don't have a governing board. It's important to note that this board, as I mentioned earlier, got its real authority very late in the process. And so, you know, as you're looking to kind of point fingers at who was to blame here for the system not working on October 1st, I mean, the board was there. They were working for several months, but did not assume their full authority until 5 weeks before enrollment went live. So I do think that the board has to receive a limited amount of blame for whatever problems there were. The board was responsible for developing policies during that initial period. We found that they did, but some of the policies they've developed haven't been implemented. There are supposed to be quarterly and monthly financial reporting to the board that generally hasn't been done. There are supposed to be targets for performance in a number of areas that have not yet been developed. Regarding the MNsure administration, and as I mentioned, there is a CEO who is the lead administrative official. That person is accountable directly to the board that appoints him. So there is not direct accountability to elected officials. During 2013, when MNsure was trying to get the exchange ready to go live, administrative leadership within MNsure was not very forthcoming about some of the problems that they were encountering, so that people, as I mentioned before, like the board members, the governor, MMB, were not given as much information as we think they should have received. So as Mr. Noble said, this staff worked very hard to try to put in place an exchange. But there was a fundamental miscalculation about how much time and energy and work it was going to take to get this system functional by October 1st, 2013. As it turned out, we really didn't come close. There were a lot of pieces and very important pieces that were missing. What about the governance of this IT system that has been developed? Who sets the priorities for that? There are multiple agencies. You've got MNsure and DHS that use this system for eligibility decisions. You've got the Office of Minute Services that built the security parts of this system and now have to maintain the system going forward. There was something of a governance structure for this system in part of 2013. It kind of fell apart when the technical problems with the system arose. And then in late 2014, those three agencies tried to reconfigure something and have an informal governance structure today. But if you look at the state laws, if you won't find anything about it. There's no interagency agreement. There are no bylaws that explain kind of how this governance structure functions. DHS expressed particular concern to us about the informality of this process and would like greater clarity about both the roles of the agencies and the composition of this governance structure. So our recommendations in this report are largely related to governance, at least those that we make to the legislature. We think that state law should clarify and should be amended to ensure that the governor, rather than the MNsure board, appoints the MNsure CEO. And again, that would make a more direct line of accountability. And we think that this is an agency that is important enough that it needs that direct line of accountability to an elected official. Doing that would raise a question of, well, what do you do then with the board? Should it continue? Should it continue to be a governing board? Should it just be an advisory board? We think there are some pros and cons to those different options. We lay them out in the report, but don't have a recommendation about what should become of the board. We do think that there should be statutory clarification about governance of the enrollment system, who's going to be a part of that structure, and what should the composition be. And finally, we think that MNSHR should be subject to ongoing oversight by the Office of Minute Services. As I mentioned, it's currently exempted. One other point that I want to mention, because I think it's been one of legislative interest and concern, has to do with data security. We talked with Minute, our state's IT experts. What I can tell you is that they feel that the MNSHR data security is the best in state government, that it has been a model to be copied by other agencies. I can also tell you that not everything that has been put in place is fully compliant with the federal data security standards that have been established for exchanges. There have been a couple of independent audits of the data security, one that was before the exchange went live, one that was done last summer, and both of those have shown some areas that don't meet the federal standards, and Minute has said it's going to continue working to get full compliance. MNSHR was required by state law to have what's called an audit trail. Let's say you're an enrollee in the system and you want to know, has anybody accessed my records that doesn't have appropriate access? Well, MNSHR can go in and they can look up for you your record and find out who's accessed it. What they can't do that they intended to have was a broader capability to go in for the entire system and say, are there indicators here that somebody's been in and looking at records that doesn't have access? So they can do individual lookups, but they can't do this on a large scale. And finally, we observe that MNSHR has a wealth of data that they've collected on people who've enrolled and tried to enroll. And that's can be a very good thing for management information, but the information in MNSHR systems is extremely hard to extract, so that even they, for their own management purposes, can't get at a lot of that data very readily. And we think that's a problem. I mean, you have questions, you go to MNSHR, they try to get information out of the system, and it's a long, slow process that needs to be addressed. So overall, again, I think what we say in this report is that MNSHR overpromised and it underperformed in the first year. A lot of people, whether they were consumers, health insurers, brokers, county staff, we could go on. A lot of people put up with a system that did not work as expected. And there were people who needed insurance and couldn't get it when they needed it. And many of those organizations I mentioned had to go through a lot of extra work to try to make this work. MNSHR faces continuing challenges. They've got to be financially viable for the long term. The system's got to provide a better user experience. And as Mr. Noble said, we've got to make sure the eligibility decisions are done accurately. So the bottom line is that MNSHR has got to execute better, and it's got to be more accountable. Mr. Chair, we'll end there and open it up for questions.
Let me just say that the bills I've read in regards to this issue picks up some of the stuff we're talking about here, the fix-up bill. What I will call the fix-up bill takes in some governance stuff and some of your other legislative recommendations. So people are working on this, but we're not there yet. But anyway, Senator Reinhart, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, to echo that point, first of all, Mr. Altert and Mr. Nobles, thank you. You know, I'd be remiss as chair of the Legislative Audit Commission, at least for another week or so, and not acknowledging that this is why we have you and your staff to take on important topics like this in an unbiased way and give us the good, the bad, and the ugly for us to consider and figure out how to improve and move forward on. So, you know, my appreciation. I know well how hard the staff works, and thank you to all of you. I do want to dig in a little bit. I think probably not surprisingly, the nexus for this committee is around the insurance connection, and as the chair rightly reminded us, we spent a lot of time on that topic a couple of years ago. I think we should talk a little bit about the compensation recommendations, but I want to dig in to the governance issues. One of, I think, my biggest disappointments was, you know, we felt, or at least I felt, that both providers and insurers were stakeholders in all of this and had a stake and ought to have a voice in shaping this as it moved forward. And for various reasons, that didn't take place. And Mr. Alters, I read through the recommendation, and I've got a lot of yellow highlighter on pages 55 through 58. And I do think that the Lori bill addresses some of those issues. But I'm curious what you and the other audit staff found, not just in the board, which you address, but in the advisory committees that were meant to address those issues with the board, since providers and insurers and others were strictly forbidden from being members of the board because apparently we couldn't see our way around conflict of interest issues, though we address it with other agencies, as is pointed out in the report. You know, members, you will recall, we set up these advisory committees to give them some voice and some input. And it seems to me, and from the conversations and input I've had, that they have largely failed in doing that and addressing some of these issues. And I'm curious if that's what the audit staff found or if you have any insight into sort of that next level down on the governance structure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Reinhardt, first let me start with the board composition. And there are some prohibitions in the statute on who can be on the board. And I guess just an observation that we would make is that's probably an unusual thing. I mean, normally when you have boards in the state of Minnesota, we've usually relied on conflict of interest laws so that you exclude yourself when a conflict arises. That's certainly one approach. We chose not to make a recommendation on the composition of the board. I mean, we think that there are some arguments for including more of the types of people who understand kind of on the ground the insurance business. We understand as well the concerns that others have raised about, you know, the board being captive to certain interests. There are arguments for both sides, and so we chose not to make a recommendation in that area, but we thought it was a point worth discussing, and on page 58 we have a brief discussion of that. I should also mention there's a discussion, I think it's on pages 11 and 12, where we're talking about the governing board, but we talk a little bit about other states and how they've set up their boards. And you'll find a mixed picture. I think Minnesota is one of three states that has the kind of exclusion that we're talking about of broker. I'm trying to remember the groups that are that we mentioned here, but healthcare providers, insurance agency reps, and health insurers, I guess, are the groups I was thinking of. There are some other states that, like us, don't allow those people to serve on the board. I would say there are other states that are at the other extreme that say that rely on conflict of interest laws and don't have any particular exclusions. So it's a mixed picture. In terms of the advisory boards to MNsure, we didn't look at them in depth. We heard some of the frustration that you just voiced about whether those groups have sufficient impact on the board. But I don't think I would want to give you a definitive answer on that. We didn't talk to enough people who serve on those boards to give you a clear picture.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add one thing, because I know this is going to be a major point of discussion during this legislative session. I think it would be really helpful to think about why you want a board. What uniquely do you want this board to do? Because MNsure, as a enterprise, in many ways is a very, very technical enterprise, which takes staff to build and operate. You can't have a board that shows up, you know, and whatever their background is, every month or so and really get deeply involved in running such a technical, a software system, a computer system. So, but there's still beyond that may be some policy choices that you want a board to make, because it can have public meetings, it can represent various interests, but to actually build and operate the MNsure system, it seems to me, you know, a board doesn't do that. And in fact, that's why I think we want that person who is most closely daily involved in running the enterprise, the computer system, to be directly accountable to the governor. And I might say, confirmed by the Senate, which doesn't happen now. I think as you approach this question about whether to have a board, if to have a board, who should be on the board, what do you want the board to do? What uniquely are its functions? Because running the enterprise of a computer system isn't necessarily what a board does.
Senator Kazoka, follow up, Senator Rainer.
Just a short follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just, Mr. Chairman, say, you know, as we move forward, I think this idea of even if this is internalized of an advisory board, it, you know, ought to be back before this committee, and we ought to again have this conversation about how do we factor in these stakeholders that I think have a meaningful role to play. I mean, as I think about some of the significant hurdles we've encountered in the rollout, I can't help but think that if we had engaged brokers and providers and others in a meaningful way, we might have been able to address some of these things earlier on. So, thank you.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, because I'm thinking through that same thing as Senator Reinert, I don't know that we gave a board a real chance when we didn't allow the makeup to be what it needed to be. As I think about a board versus giving it over to the governor, the fact is it's more accountable to us, so we're going to have more say in that. The governor picked all the board members, I believe. I think 6 out of the 7 and Commissioner of DHS, so basically picked them all. You know, but we, you know, and I'll say if it was up to this committee, I think it would have been far more successful. But at the end of the day, you know, many of the ideas that many of us here embraced were intentionally left out. And Senator Reiter mentioned no insurance experts, no insurance agents involved, people that really knew what could derail things had no say. We intentionally left them out of there. I mean, we have roughly 75% less agent brokers involved, or I think it's come up a little bit from that, but they're not even involved anymore. Well, you know, if they'd had a voice on that board, you know, we would have known about that a lot earlier. And so, you know, I'm not sure which way we're going to go. We're going to have a lot of conversation about this, but the way it is right now, we all agree, is not the direction.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I find it kind of interesting we're having this discussion about the board when we had this same discussion a couple of years ago, and then we turn around, we pass a bill excluding all these people, and now we're saying we should have had on the board. That's a discussion we had a couple of years ago. So I think if we're going to be pointing any fingers, it has to get pointed right at the legislators. We're the ones that passed a bill that disallowed people from being on that board that should have been on there. So, you know, I don't think that this is something the exchange caused. I think we caused it ourselves.
Well, shame on us a little bit there. I agree with that. I mean, on the barber board, I suppose you have barbers, and the engineering board, you probably have engineers. But here we are today. Here we are today. It's the law of the land, like I've always said. Let's fix it up and make it better. And we're going to do that. We're going to do that. We have to do that. And we've got some wonderful recommendations so far. And we've got very good committee members that participate. And we're going to end up with hopefully a pretty good product at the end of the day. Senator Kosoka.
Thank you. Again, I would, most of my questions would be directed toward MNsure. They have some representation here. But this one I think you guys might be able to answer for me. On pages 112 and 113, it was oversight of navigators. And you had commented that even though 30 grantees failed to meet their outreach or enrollment goals, MNsure did not withhold any grant payments for performance reasons. And what I'm questioning then when I go to the chart, exhibit F1, I want to know, for example, Dakota County, we gave them $190,000 and they had zero people enrolled. Did they get money the next year? You know, that's why, because of the way it's
said. You should have picked out that county.
Plant, Planned Parenthood, $150,000, they enrolled 11 people for that. Did we give them money the next year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, and I'll speak first to what little I know about the example of Dakota County, but our understanding, and I don't think we have a full understanding of it, but is that the Dakota County case was a bit of a special case. They were apparently working to enroll people, but they, for whatever reason, were not reporting enrollments to MNsure. So I'm not sure why. We've kind of wondered that ourselves. I think my understanding is the rest of the grantees that are shown there, those are legitimate numbers. We looked at the enrollment numbers that were reported to MNsure.
I see nothing in this report about the budget. Did you guys, were you asked to look at that too? I mean, I'd be curious to know how much money came in, how much money went out. I think we kind of left that thing wide open, and they could pay salaries what they want to do or whatever they feel like. Is that true? And does that make sense? I mean, we should, maybe not today, but that's probably why we should have some governance over this so we could see their budget. And I think that's one of the path that a couple of these bills want to go down too. So we know what the taxpayers, what's going on, and we don't know. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, just a comment on that. There's a little discussion on pages 19 and forward about the budget.
Maybe I missed it.
I think there has been frustration that we've heard from members of both parties. MNsure is required to present its budget to the legislature, which it did last year. It will be doing this year. I know that last year members felt that the budget document was brief and didn't provide them with much explanation. I'm told that the format that will be used this year will comply with what MMB requires of other agencies. They haven't brought that to the legislature yet, but I think in March they're scheduled to do so.
Yeah, we should hear about it. What they're doing. Senator Pratt first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To kind of get back on the governance a little bit, it's my understanding that Director Malmlov was appointed by the governor, and in this period when the board was not in charge, is it clear who Director Malmlov was accountable to? Was she accountable to the governor? Was she accountable to the Commissioner of Commerce or HHS or MMB?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pratt, that became a question that we couldn't really get an answer to, frankly. I ask it many times, various people in the executive branch, who appointed her? And ultimately, after several conversations with the Commissioner of Commerce on that subject, he said that she simply emerged.
Immaculate.
Immaculate.
I think at that point in time, it was somewhat sensitive to acknowledge who actually had appointed her. So it was difficult to get a clear answer. And I'm being serious. That is the answer that we got. No, I don't think she was directly appointed by the governor. I think the governor was aware. I mean, we interviewed the governor. The governor was aware that she had emerged as the leader of that group. But then formally, once the board was established, they appointed her. So that's the best answer I can give you. Actually, you may have heard that we actually tried to interview the former executive director. Among all the people, and we interviewed many people, we thought it was important for our insight and information to interview her. and important to give her an opportunity to provide us with her perspective. She refused. I did subpoena her. She refused to honor the subpoena. And so she is the one person that would not cooperate. The condition on that she set for her cooperation was that we would pay her and her attorney's fees. And I refused to do that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Nobles. I think that's helpful because one of the more concerning findings I had was the fact that we had these red flags, and yet no state officials, and I don't know who state officials would be, were notified of that, whether it was the authors of the bill, whether it was the governor who championed this, whether it was MMB or HHS, who was the, you know, who sits on that board. I find that to be a gross malfeasance in that fiduciary responsibility, and that's why I'm trying to figure out. And thank you for the eMERGE comment, because that helps me understand why maybe some of that clarification wasn't happening, or that notification. Can you give any other insight on that lack of communication of red flags prior to the enrollment period?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pratt, just a little bit of context. I mean, obviously, there was an enormous amount happening as this exchange was heading toward October 1st, even months before. Things were moving at a rapid pace. And I have no doubt that probably staff were providing some information to people within, and keep in mind, the place where the exchange was actually located changed over time. It started in Commerce, it moved to MMB, and then in 2013 it became part of its own agency. I think there were people in those organizations that were aware of some aspects of what was being developed. But I also think, given the magnitude of what was happening, they were not in the regular loop. And when we talked to many of those people, whether it was the head of MMB or the board members in Minsure, many of them, looking back, expressed to us a feeling, I wish I would have asked more. I wish I had taken it upon myself, and felt, I think, a certain amount of guilt looking back that they hadn't. At the same time, I think a message that we heard loud and clear was that the director of Minsure was not the most forthcoming person about those kinds of things, and was not kind of bringing things, even when asked sometimes, was not kind of putting in the laps of people who should have known things about the risks, the challenges, what needed to be done. So, you know, I think there's some hand-wringing by officials who feel like they should have done more. But at the heart, I think there was a failure by administrators to be more forthcoming.
Senator,
can I make a
James before that? So.
Sure. Well,
Senator Dane, or okay, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to me, you know, hand wringing is not good enough. You know, to me, it's. I mean, I've read this report, and we've talked about this a lot. It was systemic dishonesty. I mean, I looked through, you know, Minsure, the page 53 where they withheld information, or page 69 where the targets they set were not accurate, or Commerce and what they did with Preferred One, or how they said the rates only went up 4%. DHS, where the MA numbers that they gave you were so far below what they were supposed to be, that, you know, all the actions before the board was formed, the executive director and who was in charge. I mean, it's not just one thing. It's everywhere we look, there is a gross negligence. And, you know, and at the end of the day, had we done it right, other states have done it much better. If there had been a no-spin zone, you know, perhaps we wouldn't be where we are today. So it's not really just about whether it's a state-run exchange or federal, it's all of the components in Minnesota that went wrong, and I don't think we needed to be where we are today.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond to that, because yesterday we went through almost 6 hours of hearings about this report, and frankly what I found most illuminating and troubling is not to necessarily hear our report, because I knew what we were going to say, but to hear the current executive director express the kind of long list of things yet to be done to fix the system. So I would strongly encourage that you have Mr. Leitz, who I have found, frankly, much more forthcoming and transparent than the former executive director of MNsure. And he certainly was in the hearings that we had yesterday before the House and Senate committees. Much more forthcoming, not just about the troubles of the past, but the troubles that they face now going forward, that they have tried to fix the front end, as it's referred to, the consumer experience. But there is yet enormous amounts of work to be done on what is referred to as the back end, the transactions that need to happen after you get people enrolled. And they have a plan to spend another $34 million to fix the problems that exist today. So there's a lot more to talk about, not just about what went wrong, but what are we going to do to fix it now going forward? And not just about governance, which is a big important problem, but they've got to figure out a lot how to fix a lot of the very technical glitches. And you know, you can't do that, we can't do that, but they're the people who are in charge spending the money to do that. And that's what was alarming to me, frankly, yesterday, is not just what went wrong on October 1, 2013, but what was wrong on February the 17th, 2015.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, thank you for those comments, because I really would like, and I think this committee is trying to take a look at legislation that's coming forward, and maybe there's other legislation that needs to be created to address some of these issues. But I am deeply concerned when you read that the financial viability will depend partly on the number of people who choose to enroll in commercial products, a statement like that, and then hear from MNsure that they're still not doing the portal so that agents and brokers can do the work and have the resources to help with people that are looking for the commercial product, not just the public. So I appreciate those comments. I hope we can move to that kind of work where we're taking a good hard look at, yes, this happened, but this work is still yet to do, and somehow legislatively there should be something that we can do to move that process forward. So, Mr. Chair, I don't know what that looks like for this committee, but I know there are bills that are out there. But
well, we're going to take the best of the bills and go forward and do what we can. And we're not going to go real fast here in this committee. I mean, I think, you know, this is the Commerce Committee that deals with insurance, and we're going to take our time here and try to do it right. I think we're going to, I don't know who said it, Senator Reinhardt or somebody that, Kazalka, doesn't matter who said, but we were kind of railroaded, isn't the word, but kind of forced to kind of go a little faster and kind of give up some things that I think we kind of felt strongly about. We kind of caved in, I think, if that's fair to say, but which we're not going to do that this time, friends. Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just two questions. First, on page 30, there's some discussion about
Mr. Chair and Senator Deems, I'll take a first shot at this, and Mr. Nobles can add anything too. But there were, at this point, multiple vendors that the exchange had entered into contracts with. So generally what you had was, it was primarily, when we say state officials, it was primarily the exchange that had entered into those contracts. They were, at this point, getting some input from the Office of Minute Services. As I said, Minute wasn't brought in initially, but they kind of worked themselves in over time. Minute was not doing project or vendor management, so Minute didn't have direct oversight of the vendors. But they were certainly providing their 2 cents to the exchange staff. I would say those were the primary entities that were, I think, becoming concerned that the vendors might not be able to pull this off.
Then on page 30, Chair, on page 35, the footnote 27 talks about the governance structure. Now, at that point in time, was the MNSHR under the purview for oversight of the Commerce Commission?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deans, I'm just looking for the particular reference on page 35.
The bottom footnote on number 27, on the bottom of the page. I'm just curious if they were under the purview of the Commissioner of Insurance at that point for oversight. Or who they would have been under.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deans, the transition to MMB happened in very late 2012, so I think they were under Commerce at the time that there were some initial attempts to establish a governance structure.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of on that same section of the report, we talk about the fact that Maximus officials, on page 30, Maximus officials were told to use the selection of subcontractors as an arranged marriage by state officials, that Maximus didn't have full latitude. And then down below the Exhibit 2.4, you say the contracting process took longer than expected. This was mostly reflected by one part, the Department of Commerce's decision to change from an approach that sought multiple vendors, the best of breed, to one that relied on a single primary vendor. I guess my question is, what was the role of Commerce, not only in maybe the decision of Maximus, but also restricting the vendors that were in place? And I think the Department of Commerce is certainly under the purview of this committee. I'd like to get some clarification as we move forward.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, again, at the point where contracts with the vendors were being entered into, the exchange was housed formally in the Department of Commerce. And so ultimately it was the Department of Commerce that entered into those contracts. When we talk about the best of breed and kind of the change in that decision, that all happened during the first 6 months of 2012 when the exchange was still at the Department of Commerce.
But, Mr. Chairman, if I could just also answer that as well, because I think my understanding of what was emerging and happening at this time, yes, the development of MNSHR was housed various places. But, again, April Todd Monloff had, by this point, emerged and pretty much taken charge. And there was kind of a multi-agency group of people. There were people from DHS. There were people from Commerce. There were people from MNB. There was kind of an interagency group being directed by April Todd Monloff. And frankly, I'm not sure how, again, accountable she was to the Commissioner of Commerce or anyone else. One of the people that we interviewed, who I thought was very forthcoming, very enlightening, was directly involved in many of the questions you're asking about the contract, the contracting with the vendors, the performance of the vendors, and all those kinds of things, was Tom Baden, who now is the head of Minute Services. I suggest if you want to get into some of those issues, either at this committee or Senator Pratt, if you individually want to talk to Mr. Baden, I'm sure he'd be happy to do that. I also have a very long transcript of my interview with him that I'd be happy to share with you, because I think he was probably the person who was most closely watching what was going on during all of this time. One thing I might just mention, too, there was a question about who knew what when and how was it communicated. One of the things that they were doing, in large part, I think, because of Mr. Baden, they were having an outside company come in and do risk assessments, you know, from a more independent point of view and give, you know, green, yellow, red. And we saw those. They're in the industry called IV&Vs. So there were people who were aware of where we were red and when we were at red. And that's the kind of information that was not being conveyed, even to the board. I interviewed the chairman of the board back some months ago and asked him if he was aware of those IVNVs, the risk assessments, and he was not. He was not told that they existed.
So, and I appreciate that. And part of my question is to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes going forward. So am I to understand then that it was Executive Director Malmov that decided to restrict the contracts or who would be subcontracted with, or was it someone else at the Department of Commerce that directed that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, I mean, to my knowledge, Director Todd Malmoff was very much a part of those decisions about who the contracts would go to. I will add one other point related to the sentence that you referenced about kind of that there was, to some extent, an arranged marriage for some of the subcontractors. At the same time that we were trying to proceed and pick contractors to develop the exchange, the Department of Human Services had been also trying to figure out how to update and modernize its public program eligibility programs. They had been doing some separate exploring on that front in prior years. And one of the vendors that they liked from their reviews was IBM Curum. And so when it came time to pick who was going to be the lead contractor, who were going to be the subcontractors, I think certainly DHS got in its 2 cents, and I think the exchange officials, including Ms. Tan Malmoff, were well aware that it would be better if some of these things could work together. But I think ultimately it was a Department of Commerce decision. You know, I honestly don't know what role the commissioner himself played in that, as opposed to the exchange officials below him.
Okay, we're going to have to... Mr. Nobles and Alter, we don't want to disappoint you because I know you spent 2.5-3 hours in the other committees each, and only got an hour
and a half. So we're gonna come back. And Mr. Johnson, thanks for showing up. But I think we do want to talk to the director. And again, let me repeat: I've been around here for a while, and I think that this committee's jurisdiction and the importance of this issue. Still think that the director should have probably been here today. I know the board has their meetings, had their meeting scheduled, but darn it, the 5 members could maybe be a little more flexible than they were. That's my opinion. But anyway, thank you. We're going to continue on here, and we've got a lot. I want to just thank the committee for excellent participation, and they're very good. So, but we're see you in the future. Not too distant future. Okay, with that, when do we meet again?
Next Wednesday?
The subcommittee on insurance, I think, meets next Wednesday. So we're not okay, with that, meetings adjourned.